Welcome to the First Unitarian Universalist Society of New Haven, the home for liberal religion in this city since 1836. Our service today will deal with Faust as a type of modern man, and how Faust made a pact with the devil and got many benefits as a result. And we'll be talking about how we still retain, most of us, a degree of faith in progress, or let's say the modern program. And I'm encouraging you to lose your faith in this. I'm encouraging you to view it as a faith commitment rather than just being simple truth. So let us now greet our neighbors.
Hi.
Hi, good morning.
We can never be grateful enough to the earth, which has given us everything. Coming home to her, we come home to ourselves.
Okay, I'm going to read a couple of poems. The first is by Harje Vezat, Norwegian writer, died in 1970, more known as a novelist, but he wrote a substantial body of poetry. This is translated by Roger Greenwald. A little disturbance. A little disturbance in the almost mile-wide meadow. A child has lost its way in an ocean. The wind fluffs its hair. Blonde hair amid wild chervil and vetch. Then it's gone again for a long while. The child has lost its bearings, doesn't know where it is. Then the hair blazes up again at another spot. Has the child crawled on all fours among the snakes and rodents? It doesn't cry out, thinks it's moving in that strange world it was in before it was born, and doesn't dare to cry out. No one will find it until mowing time on a hot haymaking day. The child will not come out of the meadow. It will die in its flower bed in quiet wonder. Light as a feather, it will finally lie down in a thicket of vetch and not think. The second is a poem of Ted Hughes, who was for a while poet laureate in England. He died in 1998. He wrote a number of poems about a figure called Crow. Crow is a related to trickster figures, you know, like coyote. And the crow has the ability to be very close to his stomach at all times. As a result, it doesn't take idealism real well. And he's sort of likely to, in other words, sort of call people on their illusions. And so Crow evidently was not married, but he always wanted to be married. And so he made an arrangement with God to make him a bride. So this is called Crow's Courtship. Crow got impatient, knocking on God's door. "Hurry up with my bride," he cried, "for the years are passing." He could see old women going in by the cartload. He could hear the furnace thundering in the flues of heaven as God forged the body of his bride out of the carcasses of hags. "Silence," shouted God, "you're interrupting the great work. Only get away and be patient." Crow shuffled at the door, hummed a little. He stared down onto the hills of orchards, then stood sweating, transfixed by fantasy. Before he was aware, he was battering on God's door. "Hurry up with my bride, for the years are passing." The hags' bodies, though they were dead and red hot, screeched under the hammers of God, laminations of hag. millionfold in the blade of the bride's body. Get away, shouted God, you are ruining the work. Get away and be patient. Crow knotted his arms. His breast was a sweltering boil of the pain of impatience. He kicked open the door. God roared into tears. Crow stared wooden-eyed at the heap of ashes. The worst moment, God wept. I'm going to talk a little bit, and then I've asked Francis and Mark to make a short response to the talk. There'll be a little musical interlude first after the talk, so that we can meditate a little bit. And then we'll have some discussion time after that. Now here's another little poem by Scandinavian Rolf Jacobsen. Road's End. The roads have come to their end now. They don't go any farther. They turn here, over on the earth there. You can't go any farther if you don't want to go to the moon or the planets. Stop now, in time, and turn to a wasp's nest or a cow track, a volcano opening or a clatter of stones in the woods. It's all the same, something else. They won't go any farther, as I said, without changing the engine to horseshoes, the gear shift to a fir branch, which you hold loose in your hand. What the hell is this? The utopia of modern times was based on a vision of control through knowledge. Human good was to be achieved through domination of nature. We must put nature on the rack and extract her secrets from her, wrote Francis Bacon early in the 17th century. Through the new sciences, we shall become the masters and possessors of nature, promised René Descartes at around the same time. Women, too, had to be subjected and controlled, their sexuality and emotional energies taken out of action. This was the era in which persecution, when women were forced to undergo judicial torture, being stretched on the rack in order to extract from them confessions of foul intercourse with the devil and of infernal workings. Bacon was a lawyer. He had experience, and he knew what he was talking about. The metaphor of putting nature on the rack came easily to his mind. The modern utopia was misogynistic from the get-go. The power and influence which at least some women enjoyed during the Renaissance was slowly whittled away during the ensuing centuries. Gradually, all remnants of the feminine and or the erotic were stripped away from the main program. In the Middle Ages, knowledge had been embedded in everyday practices, and the highest knowledge of God and divine things was impossible to attain unless reason were aided by heavenly grace. The state of the knower's soul was not a matter of indifference, as it later became. Only in our own greatly admired era of progress did knowledge become inherently cold-blooded and value-neutral. Puritanical suppression of erotic love freed vast emotional energies which could be invested in the comforts and elegancies of civilization and in empire building. Denial of the body created huge reservoirs of hate which could be mobilized in the endless wars of modernity. Auschwitz and Hiroshima revealed just how value-neutral the priests of pure knowledge had become. Bacon had already spelled out the secret code of progress long before, but these horrific events of the 20th century revealed it openly. Control through knowledge. Reason alone, without love or prejudice, would carry through the program all the way to the end, the complete, radical rationalization of everything. We're talking here about a linear, one-dimensional, mechanical way of thinking. Knowledge has been reduced to pure, neutral information. All prejudice and bias have been removed from the hearts of the master knowers, including the prejudice in favor of humanity, the bias in favor of life, the irrational love of children. And love of the earth? Forget about it. Knowledge, knowledge, über alles. This was the secret code. And through knowledge, total control. In the past, it was understood that knowledge and love must be linked in the superior person. This was the ideal of wisdom, an ideal now relegated to greeting card sentimentality. In practice, wisdom has no operational function in modern times. It is excluded. Only value-neutral knowledge gets any respect. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, George H.W. Bush announced the arrival of the New World Order. Even at the time, the phrase seemed to have a cold, uncanny flavor, shades of thousand-year Reich. The New World Order is the final stage of progress, the control society. Nowadays, misogynistic images of women flood the media. Nuclear weapons proliferate, along with increasingly urgent advocacy of their use. After all, why have this beautiful military if you can't use it? As the first female Secretary of State so aptly asked. If you have the ultimate tool of total control, you're going to use it, no? And indeed, we have been waging a sort of stealth nuclear war for many years now, first in Yugoslavia, then in Afghanistan and in Iraq. We have sown their fields with depleted uranium, yielding already a rich harvest of birth defects, cancers, and mental breakdowns. Universal surveillance has been imposed here at home. Torture has now been accepted as just one more necessary tool in our already bulging toolkit as we move on to the absolute utopia, full spectrum dominance. I don't know if people know that phrase. That is a phrase that is in official government documents about the military and foreign policy perspective of the United States. In other words, no other nation will be allowed or group of nations will be allowed to reach a point being able to challenge the United States. Full spectrum dominance. They don't mince words, you know. In order to control nature, it turns out, you have to control people as well, which for most of us means we have to accept being controlled. This is the package which has been sold to us. We have achieved the utopia of Bacon and Descartes. It is utter devastation and disaster. It can and will get a lot worse if we keep going the way we are going. Our culture has objectified nature. It has objectified colonized peoples. It has objectified women. It has objectified the various sorts of Untermenschen here at home. And there is no place whatsoever for earth-based peoples in the ideal city of our modern dream. We are turning many of our young men into Rambo robots, addicted to pornography and incapable of real relationship. Finally, all of us who identify with the masters and their program objectify our own souls. We employ every sort of drug and psychotechnology in order to adjust our inmost being to the program. You are either for the program or you are against the program. And mostly we are poor, weak people. We want to be on the side of the winners. We want to be safe. But wait, what if those who are presently riding high, a doubt appears in spite of universal propaganda, what if they are not the winners after all? What if the days of the total controlled society are numbered? It is getting harder and harder to conceal the fact that we are turning the earth into a desert. This is supposed to be some kind of success for the lords of progress? What if during an unmedicated moment, a feeling of disgust for the program rises from your deep insides? We are coming into the end game of the modern utopia. The oceans are dying. The Amazon rainforest, according to one current theory, might suddenly flip, becoming a dry desert within a period of only 2 or 3 years. We hope this isn't true. And the ice is melting, no doubt about it. These are facts. We must turn away from this vision of control through knowledge. It is time for the reign of the lizard men to end. We must admit to ourselves that the cold-blooded objective approach hasn't worked out as promised. It is time to lose our faith in progress. I'm talking about a radical existential crisis. Like the coyote in the Roadrunner cartoons, we suddenly look down and realize that that there is no ground underneath our feet. Our whole culture has been living in fantasy. Loss of faith means you just don't believe in it anymore. It is not going to work out. Our present state of disconnection from the earth, from the community of living beings, from our own bodies, and from each other is suicidal. George W. Bush is a Jim Jones figure seducing us into a suicide path with promises of ultimate fulfillment and salvation even. And we might also point out that Bill Clinton was even better as Pied Piper. Civilization has become a suicide path. This is what will be revealed to you when you lose your faith in progress. To lose one's religion can be a shattering experience. Survival is not guaranteed. You need something to fill the void, but your chances of making it will probably be pretty good if you find a new, more adequate object for your affections, your trust, and your ultimate loyalty. Progress has been at the center of our identity. Our teachers taught us this, but now we have reached the breaking point and we need new loyalties, new watchwords, a new vision. The earth is enough. Women and men together learning the path by walking it. Love the earth. Earthly love is best. Stay put. Get married to a particular place. Dwell there. Learn to know and love the earth through an ongoing intimate relationship, an attachment to a place. To understand and be loved is to love her more and to love her better. The institutions of knowledge and science must undergo a profound metamorphosis. Instead of control and domination, science must aim at knowing the earth in order to preserve and fulfill it, and in order to accommodate our human life ways to her nature. We, not the earth, must yield and adjust. She must increase, we must decrease. No doubt this seems extreme and utopian, but it is no more utopian than the modern program was at its inception. And it is, in my opinion, the only path which offers us a way out of the trap which the world has become. We must rejoin the community of life. We must confess that the laws of ecology apply to humans just as much as to other species. The workings of the modern machine are well known to us. Nothing but further devastation awaits us if we allow this dystopian machine of progress to continue to grind up the world. It's a dead end, folks. We know this in our heart, but we don't want to admit it. We don't want to admit that we invested all that we had in a failure. We don't want to give up our faith in this God who has given us. We don't know who we will be if we lose this faith that has so totally defined us and made us who we are. It is time for us to repent now. Our sin is this. We have failed the earth. We have not loved her as we ought to have done. Utilitarianism cannot grasp this. And she says to us, okay, one last chance. This time, don't fail. It is a great grief to admit that we have despoiled and raped and wrecked our own mother. It is a horror to allow ourselves to feel how cold and empty and hopeless this artificial world of progress has become. How meaningless our improved gadgets are on a burned-out planet. Turn your hearts away, then, from the arrogant cruelty of the New World Order. Renounce the cold-blooded God of progress and all his violent ways. Put away the satisfactions of flying high and fast above an earth smoking and pillaged. Repent of your desire to build the ideal city on the ruined and shattered body of your own mother. Love the earth. Turn now to her with all your heart. She is the one who has given us everything. Relax into this reality. We can never be grateful enough to her. And after all our terrifying mistakes, she is still giving to us. We are still utterly dependent upon her. Let us attach ourselves to her as a baby holds to its mother's breast. Let us love her also with a mature love, an adult love, a deeply fulfilling love. Making love with her face to face. Friends, consider it. Why else do we live?
The so-called Faustian bargain has never been a particularly good one. It's really odd that anyone would go for it. I mean, this thing comes to you and says, I'll give you anything you want right now, and you can enjoy it for as long as you live. And then for the rest of eternity, I'll punish you. That doesn't really sound good, not in a long view. But that is exactly the problem with the Faustian spirit, is that it externalizes the future. This is what capitalism has done. It's good that we started with Francis Bacon, because Francis Bacon seems to have been a real Faustian character. And he did indeed want control over nature. There's an interesting quotation from him, which Elizabeth will read.
Knowledge and power meet in one. Nature, to be commanded, must be obeyed.
So he had some awareness that nature would get her innings. And he thought that if you just made a few concessions here and there, you could still put her on the rack and she wouldn't kick at this. I don't quite understand it. But there's always more, you see. The earth is so entirely resilient and beyond the power of mere humans that no matter what we do, well, when your ambitions become as large as human ambitions have become, you discover that the earth is very small. We had to go out into space to get that proper viewpoint. And it's curious, too, to turn to Goethe's Faust. And what Faust wanted, apparently, was to reclaim some land from the ocean, sort of as the Dutch had done, and there to live with free men, one assumes women too, he just doesn't mention them, on a free soil with a free mind. And if you could do that, then you could say the moment is fair and bid it last, in which case you would be turned over to the devil. That was the nature of the bargain. The irony. Now, that land that Faust reclaimed would be threatened by the little Fausts, by the global warming that's a result of a whole satanic enterprise. So I wanted just to mention something from Goethe's Faust. In the fourth act, which is... this might be in the first act of the part two. The archbishop, who is also the emperor's chamberlain, comes in because Faust has been talking about nature and spirit. And being a good ecclesiastic, he has his radar out for such horrible concepts. And he says, nature and spirit, say rather, sin and the devil. So that, I'm afraid, is what Christianity has thought about nature, that we naturally sin and that only coming grace can get us beyond that. It's a hard thesis to argue against, actually, when we see what we have done. But optimism is certainly possible. A change of spirit, a change of way of thinking, a whole new epistemology, and a whole new religion is necessary and possible. Carl Jung also looked at nature and spirit and had a more positive thing to say.
Where spring-like joy and expectation reign, spirit can embrace nature and nature's spirit.
So, being filled with spring-like joy is a good life project. It's one I've taken quite seriously, actually. And the only other thing I would mention is that one of my great inspirations is in the poetry of William Blake. And Blake and I do not always agree, because Blake sees nature as in itself barren. He says, the Pope of Rome thinks that the Virgin Mary and the goddess nature are one and the same. But the Protestant thinks that nature is barren. apparently until you have imaginatively reinstilled nature with spirit, nature cannot produce anything. This is very curious, and it arises only from the assumption that humans alone have souls. And all the rest of nature, as teeming and various as it is meaningless and worthless because it doesn't have this spark that was given solely to us. That's, I think, one of the few besetting sins of Blake, but everyone can judge or not judge as they will. Nevertheless, when I read what Fred had to say, the following quotation from Blake struck me as a good summary of the, shall we call it, the Freudian spirit. And I'm just going to mention that Bacon, Newton, and Locke are often mentioned by Blake as the unholy trinity. He disliked anything that reached even slightly of deism, because he knew that you could not come to God or to the imagination through the use of reason alone.
For Bacon and Newton, sheathed in dismal steel, their terrors hang like iron scourges over Albion. Reasonings like vast serpents enfold around my limbs, bruising my minute articulations. I turn my eyes to the schools and universities of Europe, and there behold the loom of Locke, whose wolf rages dire, washed by the water wheels of Newton. Black the cloth in heavy wreaths folds over every nation. Cruel works of many wheels I view, wheel without wheel, with cogs tyrannic moving by compulsion each other, not as those in Eden, which wheel within wheel in freedom revolve in harmony and peace.
I'm going to put kind of a different slant on things. I read a book by Kirkpatrick Sale called Human Scale that kind of changed my thinking on the environment. And actually, it's not a very good book. It's like 600 pages, and I think I read like the first 150 pages, like I got the point, you know. Ideology and putting everything faith and reason, you know, kind of and being the anti-nature, you know, Western society's anti-nature, and that's what's causing problems. I agree with all that, but there's also a problem just of scale is tends to be the real problem. And when you look at anything that what we humans are doing, there's really nothing individually that we're doing that's so bad. It's just when you magnify it to the scale of it. For example, an idyllic thing is a village or a hamlet of 20 or 30 houses, each with their own gardens, is an idyllic thing, and we all like that. And that's where we want to go and find those places. If you take that same thing and you, instead of having 20 or 30 houses, you multiply it to 5,000, each with their own half-acre plot, each with their own garden, now you've got a sprawling suburb. And then you keep spreading those more and more, and now you've got to start clear-cutting the forest for all the lumber, filling in, replacing farms, you know, taking farmland and putting houses on it to sustain it. But at the individual level, it's really everybody wants their house and for their family to have a yard in. And no one's doing anything wrong. No one's making a bad decision. So on the individual level, nobody's intending any harm. It's the aggregate effect that is evil, or is the harm. And that's kind of the trap, is that And sort of in almost all parts of the environmental crisis, it's really, even, you know, there's really nothing wrong with pollution. Humans have been polluting forever. All animals produce waste. It's, again, it's the scale of it where we can't absorb it into the environment anymore. So it's some of the kind of, I think it, At the level of everyday people, they're really just making decisions to choose for a better life. What's going to be the best for my family? And the thing is, you want to do what's best for your family. There's this, the aggregate effect is really bad, but human nature is not to worry so much about the greater good of society, these kind of abstract things, which seem kind of remote, and say, well, my little thing I did has no, it's my effect is trivial. My individual effect is trivial. And pretty much everybody's individual effect is fairly trivial. You're not individually harming the environment. It's the aggregate that's the problem. So in that sense, when environmentalists, ecologists kind of start chiding and moralizing, it can fall a bit flat because people say, but I'm not really doing anything that bad. It's, because, again, they're looking at the individual level. At the aggregate level, there might be a moral problem. But, again, that's kind of a remote thing. It's very hard to get people to focus on that. And it's more the saintly person who's going to sacrifice their good, and particularly the good of their family, for this more abstract common good. I think that's why the environmental problem is so intractable, because it's kind of this trap of the individual versus the aggregate. It's very hard to get anybody to act on the aggregate level. So how do you approach it? How would you approach it? So one interesting area where the problem kind of seems to solve itself is, which was the original main problem, is just the incredible expansion of human population. And through no particular plan or compulsion, in developed societies, it happens, you know, over and over, like in different countries, population growth suddenly naturally comes to zero population growth. And it happens because, the analysis seems to be that as societies get a little more developed, women have more opportunities, they can, you know, have education and careers, so they want to have less children and put off to a later age, and they don't choose this because they want to save the world. They choose it because it's a better life for themselves and for their families. That kind of solution seems to be what's needed. And in terms of like the bioregionalism, I think that the real promise of that, the whole idea of that, is present people an idea so that they see that it's a better lifestyle, it's to their benefit, say, to get their food at the local farmers market. That it's a benefit for them and their family rather than for this huge aggregate. And it has that indirect effect, but the real way to get change is to kind of win the hearts and minds of people, just what's for their benefit. And because no one is, again, there's really no one out there saying, I hate the earth and I don't care. Well, there are people. There's a lot of people making a lot of money off the current system. And they're the ones who say, you know, sure, we'll clear cut the forests, you know, to provide housing. But you know, the normal person has no enmity towards the earth. And environmentalists want to have a house with a nice, you know, they want to have their half acre also. And it's hard for them to give it up also. So it's providing that alternative motivation, I think, is the key, kind of at the individual level.